Teruan Saranai, welcome to our live stream on this Uposatha Day. And we'll start with homage to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So heartfelt good wishes to everyone who is joining today from different parts of the world. It's good to connect in this way. So the title for today's session is Removing What Blocks Spiritual Progress. And this is based on Venerable Mahamoggallana's teaching to the bhikkhus in the Anumana Sutta. So this is Majjhima Nikaya Discourse Number 15. Now, over 2 years ago, we published a Dhamma talk, and this was titled Why We Struggle to Understand the Dhamma. And it was also on this Anumana Sutta. So this is a very powerful teaching from Venerable Mahamoggallana, and it needs to be actively contemplated. So if there's anything that you take away from this session, it's being able to actively contemplate it and regularly practice it. It can be useful in everyday life, so at home, at work, and in the broader community when you have dealings. But at the same time, our focus for this session is really on being able to look at how we can use it to help us on the spiritual path. So in today's session, we'll revisit the Anumana Sutta and practice the Sutta meditation together. Now, what we'll cover is we'll have a quick look at how to get the best out of this session, so a few tips and reminders. But one of the key things about this session is the way we will be meditating together. So there won't be any long meditation periods, but a series of just short contemplations of just a few minutes. So everyone in this session can get a taste of what blocks us from spiritual progress. And we get the experience as well of following Venerable Mahamoggallana's instructions, and we actually purify the mind. So this is to ensure that after this session, you know you can go away and practice it afterwards. The key thing by the end of the session is that we want to be able to experience a significant wholesale change in our minds, and it's a wholesome one. So even though we may not go into deep samadhi, so right concentration, what we will do is experience concentration. And more precisely, vidya samadhi, so concentration due to effort. Now, we'll also have a broad overview of the Anumana Sutta. And this is to see why the teaching is so important. So we'll briefly revisit the sutta and highlight where it fits in, like in the greater scheme of things. And we'll also go through the instructions on how to do the sutta meditation. And it's very simple because Venerable Mahamoggallana has only given us three main steps. And we'll also have a look at the simile of the mirror, which is also given at the end of the sutta. And the bulk of the time we'll be looking at contemplating each quality that makes us difficult to instruct. And this is to purify the mind. That's the bulk of where we'll spend our time. So we want to replace unskilled states of the mind that make us difficult to instruct with skilled states. And so we're able to train in those skilled states that make us easy to instruct. And finally, at the end, we'll be able to share the merit and blessings as well. So how to get the best out of this session? The first thing is to keep an open mind. And this is really to listen to what Venerable Mahamoggallana has to say and the instructions that he's giving us. The second is to be okay with not understanding everything. Whatever we understand is fine, and whatever we're able to practice in this session is maybe all we really need to know right now, and the rest will come later. And remember that we're all seekers, we're all learners. We're here to make that effort to develop the noble path, and during this session, we're walking it together. So we're leaning on each other's spiritual faculties to make this effort. And so apply yourself to the meditation. So really give yourself the opportunity to contemplate the Dhamma during the session. So not just listen, but take the opportunity to take your own examples and contemplate. In doing that, as it says, use your own examples, because this is the way we connect with the Dhamma. When we see the Dhamma directly for ourselves with wisdom, and this can really happen when we use our own examples, then we see the Buddha. So when we see the Buddha, we see the Dhamma. The final thing is to have good wishes for everyone. So anyone who's online with us right now and anyone who has helped us to walk this spiritual path up until this point. So before we launch into the Anumana Sutta, it's really good to remind ourselves of Venerable Sariputta's words in the Dasuttara Sutta. This is in Digha Nikaya, Discourse Number 34, and it's in the section on twos. And one of the things he asks is, which two things lead to decline or falling off? So in Pali, this is Hana Bhagya. And the answer he gives is being difficult to instruct and having bad friends. So Venerable Sariputta then asks, which two things lead to progress or attainment? So in Pali, this is Visesa Bhagya. And the answer that he gives is being easy to instruct and having good friends. Now, the key thing here is to know that in the Anumana Sutta, it's really about what makes us either difficult or easy to instruct. So being easy to instruct is one of the two things that enables us to make progress and also attain on the noble path. So it's a very important thing. The second thing that is said is around good friendship. Good friendship, if you remember, the Buddha corrects Venerable Ananda in the Upada Sutta, and this is Sanyutta Nikaya, Chapter 45, Discourse Number 2. And what he says here is about good friendship, good companionship, and good comradeship, that it's half the spiritual life. This is what Venerable Ananda says. But the Buddha corrects him and says, it's the entire spiritual life. So if we have a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. So if we consider that, if we are difficult to instruct and have qualities that make us difficult to instruct, then good friends, our Kalyanamitta, will turn away from us, finding us difficult to deal with and eventually find that they can't trust us. And that would be a tremendous loss for us in terms of developing and cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path. It could delay us. It could hinder our path. It could lead to decline or falling away. And we would rather grow, make progress, and attain. So this is why these two things go really well together. There's a Dhammapada verse and a story that highlights these points really well. And it's the story of Venerable Radha Thera. And there's a separate talk on this, so you may have heard this before. And if you haven't, go and find it on Sutta Meditation Series. You'll be able to listen to the full talk. Now, before Venerable Radha was ordained, he was this elderly poor Brahmin who stayed in the monastery. And he would do these small acts of service for the bhikkhus. And in turn, he would receive food and board. Now, he wished to become a monk, but he didn't receive any encouragement or assistance towards that goal. So with the Buddha's intervention, because the Buddha could see that he was ripe for arahantship, he was ordained and Venerable Sariputta was the one that championed him and instructed him. And within a few days, he attained the fruit of arahantship. So Radha Thera was praised by the Buddha for how strictly he followed Venerable Sariputta's instructions, saying he was easy to instruct, he was obedient, and he didn't have any resentment when he was admonished or reproved for any faults or failings. So Radha Thera is a very good role model for us when it comes to having the qualities of being easy to instruct. And he was fortunate, of course, to have Venerable Sariputta as one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha to be his instructor. So the verse that the Buddha utters in this Dhammapada verse is, one should find and associate with a learned and wise person who sees one's faults and speaks reprovingly, just as a guide to some hidden treasure. It is better for one to associate with such a person, not worse. So when we are reproved or given feedback by good friends in the spiritual life, we don't often receive that as hidden treasure. So if that good friend is learned and wise, such as what the Buddha has just said, and they're coming from a wholesome place with good intent, then it's really worthwhile seeing that as that feedback as hidden treasure. We don't have to accept everything that is said, but at least we can receive it with grace and then go away and investigate it, or even ask questions like, do you have an example, or what do you mean? And then we find out whether it's true for ourselves. Now, if it is true, then we can be thankful for that feedback. Because one, it can show us something that we didn't see before. Two, it could prevent us from being obstructed from the path. And three, it could also quicken how we develop and make progress. And those that are easy to instruct, they do very much find that it makes the process a lot swifter. So now let's have an overview of the Anumana Sutta. We'll just give a broad overview. We won't go through the whole sutta word for word because there's a full-length Dhamma session that's there if you want to listen to it again or if you haven't seen it before. And that has extended explanations that can be quite helpful. So firstly, Venerable Mahamoggallana gives this teaching to the bhikkhus about two kinds of persons. The first person is someone who asks to be admonished or instructed, yet they're difficult to admonish or instruct, and they have qualities that make them difficult to admonish or instruct. So that person responds with impatience, they don't take the instruction properly, and their companions in the spiritual life start to think that that person should not be admonished or instructed, even though that they have requested for it. And in time, they consider them untrustworthy. The second person is someone who doesn't ask, yet is easy to admonish or instruct, and has qualities that make them easy to admonish or instruct. So this is in contrast to the first person. They are patient. They take the instruction properly. So the companions in spiritual life, they think this person, yes, this person can be admonished, can be instructed, even though they haven't asked for it. And the companions in spiritual life would be willing to do so and would consider this person trustworthy. In each case, Venerable Mahamoggallana explains 16 qualities that make one difficult to instruct and 16 qualities that make someone easy to instruct. So difficult to instruct is dubbicho in Pali, and easy to instruct is suvacho in Pali. So we're going to be meditating on each one of the ones that makes us difficult to instruct. Because when we make the effort to abandon the unskilled qualities, then we're able to train in the skilled ones. And it's also a sign of someone who is ready for stream entry, as well as someone who has already attained stream entry, willing to abandon unwholesome states. And also another characteristic of being a stream enterer or above is that you're willing to admit transgressions or offenses and ask for forgiveness for those things. The other thing to bear in mind is that when we cut off the nutriment for the hindrances and ignorance, which is really misconduct, so in this case, mental misconduct, then we're able to cut off ignorance and we're able to develop wisdom. So this is from the Avijja Sutta. It's very, very important because most of us don't realize when we allow defilements in the mind, then this is very supportive of the hindrances. And when the hindrances are there, that becomes the food for ignorance. Now, Venerable Mahamoggallana instructs that if we can infer and take measure of ourselves, there are three simple steps, and this is what we're going to use for the sutta meditation. So we'll clarify that a little bit more later on. Venerable Mahamoggallana also says and encourages regular review. And this is to make effort on a regular basis to abandon unskilled states. And he says that if we do so, then we can abide happy and glad that we're training in skilled states. And he also applies this simile of the mirror at the end of the teaching to help us connect with the Dhamma. And it's a simile that the Buddha has used frequently as well when teaching about self-examination of one's own mind. So it's useful to also know that. So why is this teaching important? Well, we've already seen that it details what blocks spiritual progress and it gives us a means for measuring ourselves. It also gives us clear instructions about how to remove those blocks, and that's what we're going to do today. And thirdly, it encourages regular review. So it's supportive of making spiritual progress. So the other thing that it talks about as being important is that it supports maintaining good friends. As we've seen from the suttas that we've just been through, is that when we are able to be easy to instruct as opposed to being difficult to instruct, our friends trust us and they're willing to walk the path with us. So that's the main thing. The other thing is it's a prerequisite for cultivating metta or loving kindness. So we know from Karaniya Metta, Suvacho is the third step when we meditate on the insight pathway. So we know that we remove things like envy, stinginess, derogation, disparaging when we do the meditation as a quick way of doing that particular component part. But when you look at this Anumana Sutta, there's 16 qualities. One of the things about Karaniya Metta is that if you really meditate on these 16 qualities and you remove the ones that make you difficult to instruct and you're able to train in the ones that make you easy to instruct, then you actually cut off some of those additional steps in between and you go straight to nipaka, which is prudent or wise. That's how powerful the Anumana Sutta is in terms of being able to cultivate metta. And the last one is from the Anguttara Nikaya. It talks about if we cultivate these qualities of being easy to instruct, then it leads to the continuation, persistence, and endurance of the true Dhamma. So this is from Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 4, discourse number 160. So before we start contemplating the qualities that make us difficult to instruct, it's good to gauge the state of our minds right now. We'll be taking another look at the end of our session. And for some, it's already been a very long week. So there's been a lot of activity with work and other duties and responsibilities. And we're starting to think about what's going to happen with the next working week. So the mind might feel a little tired, a little frustrated, a little sad, a little anxious, something like that. And for others, it may be a little different. But whatever the case may be, we're not judging the mind state, but we're simply taking a few moments to register what the texture of the mind is right now. So just take a few moments. So the focus of our meditation today will be on the qualities that make us difficult to instruct, because these are the blocks. So if you're familiar with suttas such as Vatupama Sutta, Anangana Sutta, Saleka Sutta, and similar ones, then you can see that it overlaps with some of these mental stains or unskilled states. So the qualities we have, if we just summarize, are has bad wishes and is dominated by bad wishes. So in Pali, this is papicho hoti, papikanang, ichanang, vasangato. And then we glorify ourselves and have contempt for others, atukansaka paravambi. And then there's four different categories of anger. So angry and is overcome by anger, angry and hostile because of anger, angry and stubborn because of anger, angry and utters words bordering on anger. And then we have five different categories of responses to being reproved or given feedback. So when we're reproved, we resist the reprover, denigrate the reprover, counter-reprove the reprover, prevaricate, lead the talk aside, and show anger, hate, and bitterness. And the last one in the set of five is fails to account for one's conduct. And then the next few are pairings of mental stains or defilements. And these are also in line with the Vatupama Sutta. So the first pairing is derogatory and disparaging. The second is envious and stingy. The third is fraudulent and hypocritical. And the next one is obstinate and arrogant. And then the very last quality, the 16th quality, is adhering to one's own views, holds on to them tenaciously, and relinquishes them with difficulty. So that's what we will be meditating on in a little while. So how do we do this meditation? Venerable Mahamoggallana gives straightforward instructions when it comes to removing the qualities that make us difficult to instruct, so the blocks to spiritual progress. The first thing he says is, we consider a person with any of these 16 qualities, making them difficult to instruct, we would find them displeasing and disagreeable. And then secondly, we contemplate, if I were to have any of these 16 qualities making me difficult to instruct, I would be displeasing and disagreeable to others. And then the third part of it is, therefore, once you see that, you say, I shall not have any of these qualities that make me difficult to instruct. So you can see it's very straightforward. The first one is, once we know what the quality is, we realize we don't like it in other people. The second part is, if we have it, well, other people wouldn't like it in us. And then as a result of really seeing and including our own examples in that, we would make a strong determination. I don't want to have this because it makes me difficult to instruct. So where we get to with this is seeing this list of what makes us easy to instruct, that if we purify our mind of all 16 qualities that make us difficult to instruct, then we get to train in the skilled states and these qualities that make us easy to instruct. So it's the opposite of what we just went through. So let's now start looking at each of the qualities that makes us difficult to instruct. So for each, I'll give a short explanation. And then if there are any useful sutra references, I might mention that as well. And then I'll give a few examples to start us off. And then we'll do a short meditation just for a couple of minutes using Venerable Mahamoggallana's instructions. So the first quality that makes us difficult to instruct is having bad wishes and is dominated by bad wishes. So papicho hoti papikanang ichanang vasangato in Pali. So the Pali word that is included here is ichanang, and that's also a term that is like a synonym for craving. So if you think about it, craving, being greedy, that is what is dominating our thoughts. This quality is best explained in the Anangana Sutta. So if you know the Anangana Sutta, this is Majjhima Nikaya Discourse Number 5. Venerable Sariputta, he lists 10 different bad wishes or blemishes and how we can get angry and bitter if people find out about these things. The first one is we don't want others to know about our transgressions or offences, so we want to cover them up. The second is we don't wish to be admonished or given feedback in public. We only want it to be done in private. And if we have transgressed, we wish for admonishment or feedback from someone we consider our equal, not less. The fourth is we wish for questions to be asked of us when a teacher is teaching the Dhamma, not others. The fifth is we wish to be put at the forefront of a group in public, not others. And the sixth is we wish for offerings or gifts to be given to us, not to others. The seventh is we wish to be the one to offer the blessing or to speak in public, not others. The eighth is we wish to receive the invitation to teach or share Dhamma, not others. The ninth is we wish to be honored, respected, revered, and venerated, not others. And the tenth one is we wish to receive the best requisite and not others. If you consider what we just read out, there's a very greedy mindset behind these bad wishes and also steeped in a lot of me and mine. So the atta is very strong here, the sense of self. So these wishes are predominantly part of the greed path. It's lobha. What the Buddha asks us to train in is always a lobha path, non-greed. So there's something not quite right with these kinds of wishes, quite obvious. Now, Venerable Sariputta in this Anangana Sutta, he gives a really wonderful simile. This simile of this bronze dish, and the owners have brought it back from the shop after cleaning. And so it's bright and clean and shiny. And the owners put a carcass of an animal or a human inside. They cover the dish and then they go to market carrying this bronze dish. Now, when people stop them and ask them what they're carrying around like a treasure, they raise the lid and they show the carcass, the remains of the carcass inside the bronze dish. So as soon as people see that, they are repulsed and disgusted. And this is meant to demonstrate to us, the simile, that if we have such bad wishes, then our friends in the spiritual life would also be repulsed and disgusted. If you think about it, the first step of doing this meditation is, would I like this in others? And we've all come across people, we've observed behavior such as what we've just read out. And when we think about it, we don't like it. Just like carrying this bronze dish with something yucky inside, we are repulsed by it. And when we look at, if we have our own examples, if we have things like this, bad wishes and being overwhelmed by bad wishes, other people wouldn't like it in us. So for example, we might not want other people to know that we argue with our neighbors and have harsh speech, or that we're cheating on our partner. We may not want other people to know that we're doing something bad at work, or that we're having problems with our relationship with our children, or something like that. Another example could be in terms of receiving feedback. We're very concerned about who we receive feedback from, so we might not want to receive feedback from someone who is younger or junior to us. So there's a sense of bias towards age, or it could be older, or whatever the case may be. And the same with gender. We may prefer someone of a similar gender or not someone of a different kind of gender not to be giving us feedback. And the same thing with people at work, someone we don't like, we may not want to receive feedback from somebody like that. So we have these particular preferences and that obstructs. We have these bad wishes. The other one is if we go to a place and we expect to be invited to eat first or to get the best seat or to be praised for something we've done. we don't usually think we have these things, but once they're not given to us, like we don't get the praise or we don't get the seat or we don't get invited first, we get invited last, then we actually see it. And so it's really good to look at whether we have these things. The third step is to see that when we actually know we don't like it in others and we don't think others would like it in us, that's when we make this strong determination, I shall not have this quality. So what we can do now is do a little meditation, just a few minutes. One of the things to quickly say is, don't worry about what happens after the session, as in, can I keep to this determination? The important thing is to make sure during the meditation, when you go through the steps and you see it, you see that it's not good, you abandon it, and you make the strong determination in the meditation now. So just to repeat the steps again, we're going to meditate on whether we have bad wishes and are dominated by bad wishes, and just follow the three steps. This is not a quality I like in others. We apply our own examples and see that if we have this, other people wouldn't like it in us. And then we make the strong determination not to have this. Okay, let's do the meditation for just a few minutes. Okay, let's stop the meditation now. So we can now look at the second quality that makes us difficult to instruct, and that is glorifies oneself and has contempt for others. So this is Atukansaka Paravambi. So this is basically when we raise ourselves while lowering others. So there's a conceit and self-glorification happening. Usually we don't think we have this quality of raising ourselves, being boastful. Most of us are more self-deprecating. But the way to see it is if we have contempt for others, because when we do that, we are knowingly or unknowingly raising or glorifying ourselves. So we might say, that person isn't good at this or hasn't got that, doesn't know this, can't do that, and therefore I'm up here. So this quality is very obstructive to receiving feedback or instruction because we are thinking, we know better, what does that person know? We can do better, what does that person think they can do? Now, at the end of the day, good friends, they would become fed up with us and avoid us. The thing to do in this meditation is, again, the same thing. We don't like this in other people when they have contempt for us and they keep raising themselves. So that one's quite obvious to see. We know what that's like. But when we look at ourselves, we need to seek out our own examples and look at whether we do that and other people wouldn't like it. So an example might be, that person hasn't meditated for as long as I have. What can that person really instruct me on? Or, that person isn't ordained, but I am, so how can they admonish me about virtue, sila? Or, that person focuses too much on suttas than the actual practice of meditation. So what direct insight do they really have that they can share with me when I meditate a lot? And in a mundane sense as well, one might think, because I have this field of expertise in science or medicine or something like that, we might think that we're better than somebody else in terms of what's in the suttas and therefore what the Buddha has to say. So those are a few examples that could exist. So when you see that, you would think other people wouldn't like that in me if I have this kind of quality. So when we see ourselves glorifying ourselves in this way and having contempt for others, we need to see that it makes us difficult to instruct. So we can make a strong determination not to have this. And that's where that comes from. So again, to repeat the meditation, we're looking at, do we glorify ourselves and have contempt for others? Because this makes us difficult to instruct. So this is not a quality I like in others. And then you look at your own examples and you say, other people would not like this quality in me. It makes me difficult to instruct. So then you make the strong determination not to have this. So let's meditate on this for just a few minutes as well. Okay, you can come out of the meditation now, or the short contemplation. So we now come to the next four qualities that make us difficult to instruct, and they're all under the umbrella of anger. So angry and is overcome by anger, angry and hostile because of anger, angry and stubborn because of anger, and angry and utters words bordering on anger. So let's briefly go through each of these and how they escalate. So angry and is overcome by anger. When we receive feedback or instruction, what arises is mental hate. So it comes in the form of, how dare you tell me that? Or who do you think you are to tell me or instruct me or admonish me? Or what do you know? Or something like that. That's what's flooding the mind, the thoughts of anger at the person who is trying to help us. When the mind is like that, rather than listening, we're overcome with anger. So examples could be telling that person off in our minds, inwardly fuming, resisting completely what they're saying. The second one, angry and hostile because of anger, this is where we've labeled a person who is giving us the feedback or instruction. We might even hold a grudge against them because of something that they've done before. So there's a permanency that is added to our anger because we put that person into some kind of mental file folder and we think that person has harmed me in the past, they're harming me now, and will harm me in the future. So anger has this quality. Of course, we're not going to listen to the person or heed their counsel because of our hostility and our grudge. So in our minds, we could be calling them names. We could be thinking about what they've done before. And internally, we're completely just blocking whatever they're saying to us. There's no chance. It's like no chance of listening to it. And then angry and stubborn because of anger. Here we're angry and we're stubbornly holding on to our position like a battle. So we might have listened to a little bit of it, and then because they're talking about something that we don't agree with and we're getting angry, we just hold that position. We're not willing to back down from the anger. And so we would be thinking, whatever you have to say is not acceptable, and you're making me angry with everything you're saying, and you're completely wrong. I don't accept anything you have to say. So that's the third one. The fourth one is angry and utters words bordering on anger. Here we're about to blow up, but we haven't verbally expressed harsh speech yet. So we're getting there. An example could be, instead of actually having harsh speech, our face might be demonstrating our anger. So we look extremely unhappy, maybe even angry. Our arms could be crossed in a very defensive mode. Or we could be fidgeting or making rough movements with our hands. And maybe we're even starting to make rude noises or sounds of exasperation. And in our minds, we continue to fume. We continue to think, oh, I'm going to mess you up if you keep telling me about this because it's not something that I want to even hear. So you can see how it escalates. Now, anything to do with anger is harmful to the noble path because it's part of the hate path. It's the dosa track. And Buddha, of course, encourages us on the Noble Eightfold Path to walk the non-hate path, adosa. We all know when we've been on the receiving end of anger, it's not fun. It's never pleasant. And we'll often do our best not to be on the receiving end. We'll avoid it. So that's something to really bear in mind with this. Now, anger is also the condition for derogation and hostility. So we can see that it's very obstructive to receiving feedback or instruction because we put up very strong mental blocks towards anyone trying to give us advice, any feedback, any instruction. So when we have this kind of strong aversion, then we would reject feedback or instruction. And eventually, we would want to act on that. So we would verbally start to express the anger. And we may even physically respond in anger, which is even worse. So all of this becomes very unhelpful to the spiritual path and to having good friendships. Again, good friends, they would want to avoid us rather than being around us. And that is a loss for us. So to do this meditation, we're not going to meditate on each one. Instead, just for a few minutes, just pick one of these forms of anger and explore it. So we can definitely see we don't like this in other people, especially if it escalates. And when it comes to our own examples, we think about it could be a mundane example at work where we perceive someone as lazy or slack. And when they give us a piece of advice, we're not willing to accept it. And we might be hostile towards them because of the grudge we're holding because we consider them lazy or slack. So that's a mundane example. But it also arises in Dhamma, that in Dhamma groups, we can get angry if someone tries to correct us because maybe we don't like them, or maybe we just resist whatever they have to say. Or if someone gives constructive feedback about a teacher that we're following and we don't like what they have to say, we immediately get angry and we just won't budge from our position. And it could also be that we're invited to a Dhamma session, and the minute we hear that the talk is about an area of Dhamma that we are not okay with, so maybe danger in sensual pleasures or karma and rebirth or something like that, we get angry. If that's the case, the most obvious thing one can notice is if, you know, you cross your arms or you walk out or you slam the door or something like that. It's just very good to explore our own examples and to see if other people were to witness it or to experience being on the receiving end of it, then they wouldn't like it. And so when you see that, then you make a strong determination. This is obstructing my path. This is blocking even good friends. So let me not have this. So let's do this meditation for another few minutes. And again, just to repeat, so we're looking at anger and you see it's a quality you don't like in others. You take your own examples and you see other people wouldn't like that in you. And then you make the strong determination not to have this. So let's do this meditation for another few minutes. Okay, we can come out of that contemplation. So we now come to the next five qualities that make us difficult to instruct. So these come under the umbrella of how we respond when we are reproved or given feedback. They are, we resist the reprover, we denigrate the reprover, we counter-reprove the reprover, we prevaricate, leave the talk aside and show anger, hate and bitterness. And the last one is we fail to account for our conduct. So let's briefly go through what these are. So when we're reproved, we resist the reprover. With this one, we're unwilling to accept the feedback or instruction. So our mind stays firmly closed to what the person is saying. We're not listening with eager ears, for example. We're not open to investigate if it is true or helpful. The mind just simply says no. The second one, we denigrate the reprover. This next one is where we start to belittle the person who is offering the feedback or instruction. It's almost like we go into attack mode. We would rather challenge and demean the person and pick holes in them rather than look at what the person is pointing out. And so we're really not wanting to look at ourselves. So we might think or say, you don't know what you're talking about. Your practice isn't good enough. You've been doing this for only a little time and things like that. And so we put the person down so that we don't have to take on what they're telling us, nor even check on our own conduct or practice and to see whether what they say is true. The third one is when we counter-reprove the reprover. So whether we know it or not, we're also in attack mode here. Rather than simply taking the feedback or instruction and digesting it, investigating it, instead we argue back. And we counter-reprove the reprover. So deep down, there's just a lot of denial and an unwillingness to open up. We might even make stuff up in order to win the argument and get into it with the person who's giving us feedback. We might even make stuff up and argue. And then the next one is we prevaricate, lead the talk aside, and show anger, hate, and bitterness. So here, we want to change the subject, get the topic back onto something else or someone else. We might try all different kinds of topics in order to prevaricate so the discussion doesn't come back to ourselves. And the feedback or instruction that's offered by the person, we just want to avoid it. So we may also get heated and angry about it because we might be thinking, that this person is picking on me, or they're highlighting all the bad points. Therefore, we might become quite rude, we might be quite rough in how we speak back to the person, and also impolite in how we gesture towards the person. We might be pointing fingers and waving our hands, and this usually happens when we feel quite exposed by the person's words. And the interesting thing is, when we do feel exposed by a person's words, normally it means there's something good to look at there. Now, the last one is when we're reproved, we fail to account for our conduct. So this one is basically like greeting the feedback or instruction with silence, like a brick wall being blank. The person might be talking to us, but we're completely closed off. So concrete bunker, brick wall, that's what comes to mind. We don't even bother to give a response, let alone give an account of our conduct. So we're not interested, not open, not bothered to connect at all. So all these things, they're all very obstructive to receiving feedback, instruction. And what we do is that we're rejecting. And whichever way it comes, we deny, we reject, we refuse, we argue, we obstruct. Again, there's a very strong sense of self, atta, that is kicking in here. This is quite a usual response when it comes to being criticized or admonished, when people give us feedback and also when they give us advice. This is very unhelpful to the spiritual path and to good friends, because good friends, they would eventually get really fed up because that behavior becomes really difficult. And eventually they'll avoid us because they'll think it's just too difficult to be around this kind of person. And the same thing applies to the one we said before about being angry. In fact, all these qualities. And they would think, what is the point of trying to help this person when they don't want any help and they're not open? And so that type of thing really doesn't foster trust. So when you read the sutta, you immediately think, why is it that even though I ask for feedback, they end up not trusting me? And it's because this is the type of response that you're giving, that if you give obstruction, blocks, rudeness, anger, all these things, then of course you're not going to foster trust in these relationships with so-called good friends. And they won't feel safe in this kind of relationship. Now, we've all been on the receiving end of this kind of behavior, even in the conventional sense. So at home, when we give advice or feedback to people in our family, at work, of course, even though we have 360 degree feedback and everything, but still, you know that sometimes it doesn't land correctly. And also when we have dealings in the community. So we know it can be incredibly disheartening over time when you're genuinely trying to help someone in any of those contexts. So in Dhamma, it works the same, but it is a greater loss when friendships break and things like that. So to do the meditation, again, we're not going to meditate on each one. Instead, just pick an example. When we are reproved, we just basically reject it in any of these forms. So the first thing to do with the meditation, again, is we know when we experience that we don't like this in others. The second is to take our own example and to see others wouldn't like it in us, and then to make that strong determination. So examples for us, someone comes and says, oh, you're not doing metta properly. You're spreading metta to yourself, and the Karaniya Metta Sutta doesn't say that at all, so you shouldn't be doing it. And we don't like it. We say, oh, but I've learned this from the monastery, and all the monasteries affiliated with that, they all do it the same way. So how can you say that? And so rather than even being open to looking at the Karaniya Metta Sutta, you just keep arguing about the point. Another one could be that a teacher gives you feedback about something that you said or contributed, and it didn't go down that well, but they're just trying to help you so that when you contribute again in a Dhamma discussion, it's not taken in a bad way. And you might think, oh, but I've heard you talk like that before, and how can you say that? You know, and so you're pointing out their bad qualities and stuff. So there's things like that come up. And it's really good to look at how we obstruct, how we resist, how we belittle the person trying to help us, how we argue and so on. And sometimes how we just blank people. So let's do this meditation for a few minutes. Again, I'll just repeat the steps. This is not a quality I like in others. And then you take your own example and see other people wouldn't like that in me. And then you make that strong determination not to have this. Okay, let's do the meditation for a few minutes again. Okay, let's come out of the contemplation. So now let's look at derogation and disparaging. So if you're familiar with the Vatupama Sutta, so you have seen some of these mental stains or defilements before, you'll be familiar. So they're grouped together in the Anumana as pairs. And the first pair is this derogation and disparaging, so Makka and Palasa. So derogation, that can also be translated as belittling, Makka, or demeaning. So when we're angry, we tend to derogate. When we derogate, we remove people's good qualities. We belittle them, find them lacking. So we may think that person doesn't deserve that, or they don't have this experience or thing, or they shouldn't be like that. And so we can think it should be me, it should be mine. So there's something in there that we want to claim. So some examples are, one of our siblings may be more favored by our parents and praised for being generous. So instead of being happy for them, we might think, oh, they're just throwing money at the parents while I go and visit them and actually do things with my time and my presence. And so there's belittling of the act of generosity of one sibling. And in that, we might be thinking, I should be getting the praise from the parents. So that's a mundane example. There's similar examples that you probably can think of from work and different kinds of relationships. But in Dhamma, the most important one is seeing that if we derogate the Buddha. So sometimes when we're frustrated at not understanding parts of the teaching, we can belittle the Buddha by saying, oh, you know, we're more advanced now than at the time of the Buddha. It was different back then. So there's no need to understand this aspect of the Buddha. He didn't mean that. Or let's not use that part. Let's just leave that part out. And let's just try and understand the bits that we think are more favorable. And so in that way, what we're doing is removing the good qualities of the Buddha, because the Buddha was perfectly enlightened all on his own. He has 73 different Buddha knowledges. He has the perfections that he's perfected over many lifetimes as a bodhisattva to become a Buddha. He took the oath from another Buddha to become the Buddha, and so on and so forth. And even when we raise science or philosophy or some other area of study above what the Buddha has taught, then it's also obstructive. It's something to really look at without even fully penetrating or understanding the Buddha's teachings. So that those are some examples of derogation. With disparaging, palasa, this can also be translated as divisiveness or bullying. So it's conditioned by hostility and holding grudges. So when we hold grudges, there's a sense of permanency that we're assigning to the type of anger that we might have towards people. So we start saying, oh, they're always like that, or it's always like this, or what we're doing is we're measuring, dividing, and splitting, and excluding. So some examples are, if we don't like someone that is good friends with one of our friends, and we want to split them up, then what we do is we go and say that person's weak points to our friend. Or if we don't like a friend's partner, someone that they're married to or in a relationship with, then we might exclude them from group invitations or things of that nature. And in Dhamma, we have very strong preferences. Like when you really look at it, we might be of the nature to think, I only want to listen to foreign monastics, not the local ones, or vice versa. Or we might think, oh, I only listen to Dhamma from a monastic, not to lay teachers, or vice versa. Or we might think, oh, I only want to listen to senior teachers, not the junior ones, or vice versa. Or we might think, oh, I prefer listening just to male teachers. I'm not open to female ones, or vice versa. So there's all these different ways that we can disparage and divide. And so we might also try and pull our friends away, depending on how we're prejudiced or biased, irrespective of what the Dhamma is being taught or practiced. And then again, another example is back to this one about sutta study versus meditation practice. We might reject people or groups who fall into the category that we measure as less. We might exclude them. And so what we don't see is that we actually need both. We need the Buddha's teachings and we also need to practice it. So this is something that we might not see if we have that type of divisive nature. So both derogation and disparaging, they're mental corruptions. They're very obstructive and make us difficult to instruct. And so there's many more examples than what I've just gone through. But you can see they block friends from trusting us. And we can also get into very combative relationships as well, instead of wholesome ones. And so it makes spiritual progress very difficult. And more importantly, it blocks wisdom. So let's do the meditation for derogation and disparaging. So we see that we wouldn't like this in others. We take our own examples, whatever they are. And we see that if we have that quality, other people would not like this in me. And it makes us difficult to instruct. And therefore you make the determination, let me not have this quality. So again, we're looking at derogation and disparaging. It's not a quality I like in others. We apply our own examples. Other people wouldn't like it in me. And then you make that determination, may I not have this? So let's do the meditation for another few minutes. Okay, we can finish that contemplation. So the next pairing is envy and stinginess. So isuki, hoti, machari in Pali. So envy is isuki. It's also known as issa in Pali. And this can be translated also as jealousy or resentment. And it arises when we're unhappy towards another person's gain or success. Internally, we may think it should be me or it should be mine. So this is conditioned by derogation. So we often find that if we derogate, we can identify that there's also envy. It sounds like he or she can, I can't. He or she has, I don't. So some examples, like in a work example, maybe somebody got a role because of favoritism or nepotism. And so we think, oh, they don't deserve the role. They haven't got the skills or experience like I have. They should have given me that role. And in Dhamma, again, like somebody gets the opportunity to share Dhamma and you think, oh, this person's practice isn't really good enough and how they speak Dhamma is really basic. And so inside you think, oh, they should have invited me. And then another one could be seeing that somebody can enter the jhanas or the formless attainments really easily without difficulty and you know that you can't. And so what you think is, oh, but we don't really need to practice those things. It's not a big deal. So we're putting that down. And we also say, oh, it's not important because we can get too attached to them. Now, there's relative truth in that. But the thing is that it's out of jealousy that we're really saying it. Secretly, we might really want to enter the jhanas and the formless attainment. So the other quality here is stinginess, macharya. And so this can be translated as well into selfishness, and of course we know it's the opposite of generosity. So this is conditioned by disparaging. When we are stingy or selfish, we're very protective of gains, protective of things that belong to us, not willing to share, not willing to give to others. And so we start putting up clear boundaries and exclusions. So it can sound like, I don't want to give to that group. Let's not invite this person, this group, not that group. And so there are five types of stinginess, if you remember. Stinginess regarding gain, so not sharing or giving material things or gains. Stinginess regarding dwelling, so not inviting people to your home, not sharing a personal space and all that. And there's also stinginess regarding family or group. So we have preferences and biases regarding our family, people within our family, regarding race, regarding gender, regarding religion, sexual orientation, age, likes and preferences. The fourth one is stinginess regarding reputation, so around our appearance, virtue, our qualities, our attributes. And then the last one is stinginess regarding dhamma or knowledge, so not willing to share knowledge, insights, ideas, views, information. Some examples, in a mundane sense, there's so many examples that apply here. We don't want to invite certain people to our home. We don't want people to intrude into our bedroom, things like that. A mundane example could be, we're not willing for our children to marry outside of our class or marry outside of our religion or marry outside of our race. In a Dhamma sense, it could also be not wanting to share Dhamma or participate in discussions. We think, oh, let's just practice for ourselves. Or we've found out something really helpful in terms of how to access maybe one of the higher concentrations and we don't share that with friends. So things like that. So both envy and stinginess is quite apparent that they're mental corruptions and that they're very obstructive. And they block good friends because they would see, not very nice being around this kind of person. And so that would also hinder our spiritual progress and of course block wisdom. So again, let's do a meditation for a few minutes so you get the hang of this already. We don't like this in other people. We pick an example of our own and we see that people wouldn't like it in us. And then seeing that makes us difficult to instruct, this envy and stinginess, we make the strong determination not to have this. So again, we do this contemplation for a few minutes. It's not a quality I like in others. We apply an example of our own, see that other people wouldn't like it in us, and we make a strong determination not to have it. So let's do this for another few minutes. Okay, we can move on to the next pairing. And this is the pairing that is fraud and hypocrisy. So Sartha, Horthy, Mayavi. So fraud is this Sartha. It can also be translated as dishonesty, corruption, cheating, trickery. And it escalates from stinginess. So we may cheat to gain or even cheat to hold on to something that we value. And often we fear being found out as a fraud. So some examples in conventional sense is cheating on tests and not wanting anyone to find out, overcharging someone for something, misappropriating funds or assets at work, tricking people into making donations and you lie about the reason for it. It's also in terms of Dhamma, we might pretend or project a certain level of mindfulness when people are looking, but when they're not looking, we completely drop it. And that's in order to receive something. So that's not very good. It's also when we teach Dhamma and share it and we take it as ours. Like we don't attribute it to the Buddha when it really has come to the Buddha. If you read the suttas, you always find that the arahants, they always attribute the teachings to the Buddha, even if someone praises them for saying the Dhamma really well. They always give it back to the Buddha. It's the insight of the Buddha. Nothing that they've said is new. So that's also something to bear in mind if we share Dhamma or start to think of it in that way. Hypocrisy, maya, this can be translated as pretentiousness or deceit. It arises when we're fake, when we lie, when we pretend to be something that we're not. We might also claim to have something like more sila than we really have. And we might try and hide our bad qualities or transgressions. So already we know if we try and hide those things, that's not ready for sotapanna, so stream entry, or not someone who's attained, because someone who's attained would always declare, especially if asked. This particular hypocrisy is conditioned by envy. So due to envy, we can be quite inauthentic, not happy with ourselves. So we pretend and deceive others in order to show something. And inside hypocrisy, what we find are lies. There's a huge amount of inauthenticity there. So for example, the most obvious one, just like this picture shows, is when we post to social media, we usually post picture perfect posts. And it doesn't really reveal the unhappiness that is there at times, or it doesn't really reveal what it's really like. It's just all the peak moments. So it paints or projects a particular type of life, and it's not true or complete. So there's some hypocrisy in that. And then also we might advocate certain beliefs or ideals that we don't actually put into practice. So for some people, it could be that they're animal advocates, but they keep eating meat or something, or climate change advocates, and then they keep using a lot of fossil fuels or something. And so we might pretend and project these things, and deep down we're still not really walking the walk. And so when it comes to meditation practice in Dhamma, there can also be pretense and projection for reputation's sake, that we project that we keep more sila than we really do, and we project that we meditate more than we actually do, all those sorts of things. So both fraud and hypocrisy are mental corruptions that are obstructive and make us difficult to instruct. Again, you can see there's a lot of self, there's a lot of atta in it. This would definitely block good friends from trusting us and also hinder our spiritual progress. So it's very good to remove this block. So again, let's do the meditation, contemplate for a few minutes. We wouldn't like to see this in others, and therefore just pick an example of your own and see that other people wouldn't like to see this in us, and then make that strong determination. So let's do this for a couple more minutes. We can now look at the next pairing, which is obstinacy and arrogance. So this is Saddo and also anatimani, or atimani, sorry. So obstinacy, Saddo, is also translated as stubbornness and mental rigidity. So when we are obstinate, we're usually holding on to strong views and opinions. So we're unwilling to bend. We demonstrate an inflexibility, and of course it's linked to arrogance and conceit. So we don't want to listen to others. We think we are right and our views are the correct ones. And so it sounds like I'm right, you're wrong. And we assign permanency to what we're holding on to as the truth. So those who try to help us, they find us to be quite hard-headed, stubborn, and inflexible. So some examples, the first one is a mundane example. We could be not speaking to a relative or friend over some argument from a long time ago. Or it's couples arguing over household responsibilities or some other matter. And could be one person thinking as part of that couple one thing and the other person thinking another, and both won't budge. It can also be in Dhamma, very strong Dhamma viewpoints and arguing about the things, like just getting into Dhamma debates. Sometimes you also see this very much on Dhamma forums, that people just keep writing back and forth and they never agree. And so there's a lot of obstinacy. A lot of it is actually very akusala, because it doesn't actually land somewhere that is particularly wholesome. Also, we may be unwilling to hear that we're wrong in the Dhamma. And this is around certain topics. So in the world of studying Buddhism at the moment, there's many topics that are almost taboo. So even karma and rebirth, which is something that is very much part of right view. Or it might be about painful practices, dukkha-patipadas, the painful practices with slow realization and quick realization, having to do meditations on painful objects or something like that. People would prefer to do profitable direction meditations that are around pleasant practices or the formless attainment. So sometimes what happens is we can be very obstinate about not going in those areas that we don't like. But the thing is, with Dhamma, we need to look at the whole of it. So with arrogance, atimana, this can also be translated as superiority conceit. And in this case, we think we're better than others. So we have a bloated opinion of who we are, what we do, and what we know. It's caused by a lack of virtue, dusila in Pali. So this is like immorality. When we are arrogant, what it sounds like is, I'm better than you. I have more than you. No one can do what I do. I know more than you. And so on like that. When there's arrogance, it props up our sense of self, and it makes us believe that we can make things last. And so with this misapprehension, it's very difficult to want to hear the Dhamma from anyone else, let alone feedback, admonishment, or instruction. We're more than happy to live in ignorance of truth, and because we believe that we can fix things when things go wrong, throw money at it, use whatever influence we have, and also we kind of refuse to see that conditions are unlasting, subject to change, and result ultimately in dukkha. So some examples for arrogance are, we think, say we're at work, we think, oh, what I produce is better than my manager's. The talk that I would give to present is better. Or we have this attitude when we walk into any place, we think, do you know who I am? Do you know the position in the company I have? The knowledge I have? The influence I have in the community? The respect I'm given? You should listen to me. So that's what arrogance could be like. And even when we get sick, we might think, I'll beat this. I'll find the best doctors and I'll pay a lot of money and I'll obliterate the illness, and not seeing the truth about illness, that with these bodies we're of the nature to sicken. And in Dhamma, sometimes we can arrogantly think, let me practice the higher meditations and I don't need to worry about dana, giving, and I don't need to worry about virtue, sila. That's for cultural Buddhists or something, and I don't need to worry about gradual teachings. I want to do cittanupassana, developing the mind. And so that can be quite arrogant. Or we might think, my insight is better than even the Buddha's or one of these teachers. And so we think what we say in Dhamma is more fragrant. We don't want to read out the words of the Buddha because we think, oh, you know, let me share what I have. It's direct insight. And I'm okay discouraging people from the Buddha's words. Or we take something like philosophy or science and we raise it higher than the Buddha's words, and we haven't even investigated the Buddha's words fully, yet we are prepared to practice something else over that, or construct something out of a mixture of things. Another one about arrogance, while we're on it, is around when friends come and say to us and encourage, you should actually start listening to Dhamma now, you should start learning to meditate now while the faculties are still sharp. And what we say to our friends, or we think to ourselves, is, oh, I've got plenty of time. I can do this later. Let me focus on the life stuff first. I'll wait until 20 years time or something, and it'll be okay then. And the thing is, we forget, out of arrogance, there's no guarantee that there is a later. Death is coming. We just don't know when. So both obstinacy and arrogance are mental corruptions that can be very obstructive. They make it difficult for us to be instructed. Like, we've been on the receiving end of these kinds of corruptions, and we know that good friends wouldn't trust us, because if we can't trust other people because of these qualities, then why would they trust us? And so it blocks wisdom as well. So let's contemplate this for another few minutes. We don't like this in others. And then take an example of your own and see that others wouldn't like it in us. And then see that it makes us difficult to instruct, and then make that strong determination not to have the quality. So let's do this for a few minutes, and then we'll do the last one. Okay, so we now come to the last one, which is around adhering to one's own views, holds on to them tenaciously, and relinquishes them with difficulty. So this last one, it's a very important one, because we can be holding on to our own views that are based on wrong views, and we hold on to them tightly, not wanting to give them up. And you can see this is linked to obstinacy, because we don't want to give them up. This might mean that we're unwilling to test them, we're unwilling to revisit them, and we won't review them to check that we have the right view. So as we know, the Noble Eightfold Path leads with right view. If we have the right view, we have given up wrong views, and the other path factors can be developed, and they're helped with right effort and right mindfulness. If we're holding on to wrong views, then the path that unfolds is the wrong path. We get to a concentration, but it's not the concentration that leads to ultimate liberation, nibbana, and the freedom from all suffering. So what is driving this quality is past delusion and ignorance. Now, this quality is closely linked with the Bodhicitta insistence that this is the truth. So idam saccha binivesa kayagantha. So this comes under consciousness as nutriment. And in this, we are saying, my view is the truth. everything that doesn't align with what I believe is false, including the Buddha. And usually what you find is people will say, if I come to this Dhamma thing, will I lose what I believe in? Will I lose what I believe is true? And this is the thing that makes us difficult to instruct. So some examples might be holding on to strong views about worldly things as the truth. So sometimes people hold on to the modern sciences, philosophy, whether it's ancient philosophy or modern philosophy. Some people are still holding on to astrology. They still worship the sun and the moon. Some people do fire rituals. Some people are relying on Akashic records or numerology or something like that. If that's the case, then when you read the suttas and you listen to what Buddha said, he said that's wrong view. And then there are other things that come under this. It's also when we reject certain aspects of the Buddha's teaching. So we're prepared to say, let's discount karma and rebirth. And that's a fundamental component of right view, whether it's mundane right view or supramundane right view. Or we think, okay, in terms of the precepts, I'll keep the first one, the second one, the third one, the fourth one, but I'm going to ignore the fifth one. So I'll take intoxicants and I'm not concerned that it breeds negligence. So, and I don't care about the karmic result of it being madness or anything like that. And then the other part of it is, it could be about jhanas, where we're unwilling to hear about the need for jhanas, that right concentration is about jhanas and the bhujangas, and so things like that. Or it could be that we really like infinite consciousness and we really love staying in infinite consciousness as a meditation, but we're unprepared to see that infinite consciousness is constructed and not nibbana. This particular quality, adhering to one's own views, holding on to them tenaciously, relinquishing them with difficulty, is a very, very difficult one in Dhamma. And so it's probably the most obstructive one to receiving feedback or receiving instruction, because the person basically, as it says, relinquishes them with difficulty. In most cases, they don't relinquish them at all. The person who's trying to help would feel that they're just coming up to this block time and time again. And so after a while, good friends, in effect, will have to fall away, because it's very hard when someone is very unwilling to investigate and open up. And maybe the good friend leaves the door open, that at some point in the future, maybe a decade later, maybe a few years later, maybe next week, that the person would come and say, what do you mean? And so that's the hope for a good friend. Now, let's do this meditation just to complete. Again, see that we don't like this quality in others. So we've often encountered this kind of thing and we know that we don't like it. And so we find our own example, just investigate, is there anything like that for me? And then see that other people wouldn't like it in us. And then see that makes us difficult to instruct and then make that strong determination. So let's contemplate this for another couple of minutes. We've now completed the 16 qualities, so we've purified the mind. So if we imagine we are now looking at our reflection in the mirror, then we are happy that we can find no blemishes on our face. So this is the simile of the mirror that Venerable Mahamoggallana uses at the end of the Anumana Sutta. So when we see no blemishes on our face in the mirror, in the same way what we are saying, we can be happy and glad that the mind is now clean of all those unskilled, unwholesome states that make us difficult to instruct. This is a gain for us to have abandoned the qualities that make us difficult to instruct because they were blocking the noble path. And it makes us difficult for good friends to want to trust us and to want to associate with us. So now that we've removed them, it's actually a really good thing. So now we can train in the qualities that make us easy to instruct. So that helps us towards developing wisdom, to keeping the good friends that will associate with us and will help us to grow in the Dhamma and to make progress on the path. This is what we do at the end of meditation, that after you look at the 16 stains have been removed, the 16 qualities, then you think, ah, this is really good. Like we did at the beginning or somewhere in the beginning of our session, we've now meditated together. It was very, very short, but it gives you an idea. And what we do now is, again, gauge the state of our mind. And the question to ask is there more brightness in the mind? Is there some lightness in the mind? Does the mind feel happier? And so just take a few moments to check on the texture of the mind right now. Don't judge it, but just gauge how it was before and how it is now. So we've now come to the end of our live stream Dhamma session. The encouragement with this Anumana Sutta is to regularly review. So regularly review whether we have the qualities that make us difficult to instruct. And in that way, it's easier to train in the qualities that make us easy to instruct, the skilled states. When we actually do this regularly, what you find is that it makes the spiritual progress quicker. We're willing to see things and people are willing to come to us to help us. And in that way, we start to learn more in a faster fashion. So it can be very beneficial in everyday life. But most importantly, we can dwell happily, making the quick spiritual progress and also have the help of good friends. Let's now share the merit and the blessing. So if you would like to dedicate the merit from joining this session to any departed relatives, then do so now. And we can share the merit with all sentient beings. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering. Blessings of the Triple Gem. Wishing you well. Teruan Saranai.